Hi everyone, and welcome back to the second part of a supplementary video for the New Testament Survey course. This is a continuation of a supplement to our survey of the Book of Revelation. In this section, we'll finish looking in more detail at Revelation chapters 4 and 5 together, which I've entitled The Throne and the Lamb. In the previous video, part 1 of this passage, we looked at the throne in chapter 4, and now we'll examine chapter 5, where we'll see the Lamb and his importance and impact. These two chapters go closely together, and one helps us understand the other. So if you've not seen part 1 of this section, I highly recommend you check it out before this one, because we won't do much review of that chapter here, and it's very helpful for understanding this one. Let's just jump in and read chapter 5. And I suggest that you keep your Bible open and read along, and then follow along as we then work through these verses. Continuing on directly from what we saw in chapter 4, this passage says, "And I saw a scroll in the right hand of the one sitting upon the throne, written inside and outside, sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a powerful angel proclaiming in a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and to break its seals?' And no one in heaven, neither on the earth nor under the earth, was able to open the scroll or even to see it. And I wept intensely, because no one worthy was found to open the scroll nor to see it. And one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. Behold, the lion from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed to open the scroll and its 7 seals.' I saw in the middle of the throne and the 4 living creatures, a lamb was standing as having been slaughtered, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God, sent out into all the earth. And he went and took the scroll from the right hand of the one sitting upon the throne. And when he took the scroll, the 4 living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb. Each had a harp and golden bowls filled with incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, 'You are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals, because you were slaughtered, and you purchased to God by your blood people from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you made them to be a kingdom and priests to our God, and they will rule upon the earth.' And I looked, and I heard the sound of many angels around the throne, and of the living creatures and of the elders. And their number was an uncountable number of uncountable numbers and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, 'The slaughtered lamb is worthy to receive the power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing.' And I heard all creation, which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and upon the sea and everything in them, saying, 'To the one sitting upon the throne and to the lamb, be the blessing and the honor and the glory and the power forever and ever.' And the 4 living creatures said, 'Amen.' And the elders fell down and they worshiped." Now, just like in part 1 of this section, there's more here than we can possibly cover. And if you'd like to examine any part more thoroughly, I have included detailed notes on this passage in the Bible study section of the Scripture Exegesis site. But here, we'll go as deep as we can in our limited time. We'll try to understand the main point and significance of this passage and how this helps us to understand and respond to Revelation as a whole. With that in mind, let's remind ourselves of the larger context of this passage. Now, we went over the purpose of this passage and its place in the book of Revelation in the first part of this section, so I'm not going to repeat that information here. I just want to remind you that this chapter continues the same vision as chapter 4, which gives the setting for these verses. God is on his throne, perfect in holiness, authority, knowledge, and power, and all of heaven is rightly worshiping him because he is worthy. And the drama we'll see in this chapter helps explain how this God relates to what is going on in the world, and it also gives us the key to understand most of the rest of the book of Revelation. This chapter continues to answer the question, how the victorious Christ fits into history, and how we can make sense of what's going on in light of what the glorious risen Christ has accomplished, and how this works towards the promised consummation. This was especially intended to help the first readers in the suffering they were experiencing. In other words, this passage gives a key part of the eternal perspective, the explanation of what God is doing in history and how it all fits together and is working towards the final goal, and how it affects what we're living through. Similarly, we're not going to go over the outline of this passage because that was covered in part one. I'll just display it as a reminder, and we'll reference it whenever we transition from one portion of the passage to the next. So now let's look in more detail at chapter 5 and try to bring out the significance of what this vision tells us. As we see from the outline, this chapter tells the drama in heaven, which then shapes all of earthly history in some sense. And this drama can be described in the format of problem and solution. The problem is introduced starting at verse 1 of chapter 5 when we're introduced to the scroll in the right hand of the one sitting on the throne. Now, the scroll is not the problem. The scroll is a very good thing, but the scroll is the occasion of the problem. But before we can understand the problem, we need to examine the nature of the scroll itself and why it was a big deal. Because grasping the point of the scroll helps us understand the point of the entire chapter. Now, like everything else, this scroll had its source in God. It came from his right hand. It was filled with writing, but was sealed up. Now, the scroll most likely functions like a last will, in that it specifies God's intentions for his heirs. And so it represents God's plan and settled purpose for the universe, for human history, and for his inheritance and kingdom to be consummated at the end of history as we know it. In other words, this scroll represents and contains all that God is doing and will do to bring creation to its proper conclusion, to finally defeat all evil, and to bring about the full consummation of God's kingdom and all its blessings for his people. It is the blueprint and description of the blessed life of the next age. It is the content of God's kingdom purposes for history and the completion of God's plan in history. And the scroll was covered with writing on both sides, meaning that it represents the totality of God's great purposes. But the problem is that the scroll was sealed with seven seals. The scroll was completely closed up. Therefore, the consummation of God's purposes was not yet revealed and not yet enacted. This represents the already not yet tension that we've already talked about in this course. God is working in history, but he is not yet done with all that he has planned to do. There's so much more to look forward to. History, including our individual lives, is still a work in progress, but God has a plan and a promise to bring it all to its intended fulfillment. But that plan is still sealed up. And the problem of the scroll still being sealed led to the next scene of this drama, which is a powerful angel issuing a challenge to all of creation in order to find someone worthy to open the scroll and finally bring about the revelation and enactment of God's ultimate objectives. He called for someone to step up and bring God's plan to completion. However, that only made the problem worse, because no one was found worthy. No one in heaven, that is, none in the heavenly beings that we saw in chapter 4, even though they were morally pure and righteous and powerful, and no one on earth, no human leader of any kind was found worthy, certainly not me or you, and no one under the earth, that is, no deceased historical hero, not even the great ancient saints. Moses was not worthy, Abraham was not worthy, David was not worthy to open the scroll. No one was found worthy to break the seals, or even to see the scroll. Not only could no one bring about God's purposes, no one could even know what they are. And by the way, a huge part of the reason for this challenge was to clearly demonstrate that we are not worthy to open the scroll. None of us has the competency, merit, and worth to fulfill this role. None of us is able to fix our world. We never were. We never will be. No one is qualified to play God except God. Now, there's always a temptation to think that we or some other human or some human institution will be wise and competent enough to solve all our problems and bring about paradise on earth. In Revelation, we see pretenders and false prophets trying to counterfeit God and claim that they are the solution to the problems of humanity. But all of this is a sad joke, because we humans, we're the cause of our problems, not the solution. Humanity is never the hero of this story. And when we try to usurp God's role, it just gets worse and worse. All throughout history, all human schemes that promise utopia quickly turn dystopian and tyrannical. And so this passage makes it very clear that no one was found worthy to break the seals and fulfill God's purposes in history, because he is God and we're not. And John responded to this by weeping intensely, not just shedding a tear, but passionate lamenting. Now, what is going on here? Why did John mourn so severely? Was he just a drama queen? Was he overly emotional? Well, no, I don't think so. Let's think about why this was such a big deal to him. Understanding why John was so distraught is helpful for seeing the meaning of this passage. Now, of course, it clearly says that John wept because no one was found worthy to open the scroll. So let's try to connect the dots here to see why John thought that that was catastrophic. You see, if no one is able to break the seals and open the scroll, then God's purposes will remain unknown and unaccomplished. That means that millions of injustices will not be righted. The martyrs will not be avenged and will have died in vain. The evil Roman Empire will win. The devil will win. If the scroll is not opened, then God would prove to be unconnected and unconcerned and distant from our lives, like an absentee father who's abandoned us. History would have no meaning. Our lives would have no meaning. Nothing would have any meaning if no one can open the scroll and bring God's plan to completion. Because if that were the case, nothing would have a purpose or a goal or a reason for being. Because what's the point if it's not going anywhere? And by the way, that's the very conclusion of many in our secular culture, that life has no designer, that it's just random. And in that worldview, life has no meaning or purpose, and so nothing does matter. And so they say, make up your own meaning. And that's why our culture is filled with such selfishness and despair, not to mention outright lunacy and depravity. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not looking down on these depraved people. I feel sorry for them and the shallowness of their worldview, and I want them to know the truth. But that is the natural outcome of a worldview without God. And we should all feel the weight of John's grief at that point. We inherently know that something is seriously wrong with the world, and we deeply long for something to change. It needs to be fixed. And we know that our own personal history is unfinished business, and we long for the time when God will bring our salvation to its intended conclusion. And we also know that we cannot do this on our own. But if there's no one who can and will do this, then it will never get done. And that would be cause for intense grief and despair, to be left in our current state forever. That's the problem narrated at the beginning of this chapter. But thankfully, that's not the end of the chapter, because great news breaks into the story at this point. John also narrated the proclamation of the solution. John was about to be given more information that would turn his weeping into joy. One of the elders from around God's throne commanded John to stop weeping. The sadness that was appropriate before is now completely inappropriate in light of what John is about to learn. And the reason that John is to stop mourning is that the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed. Here John received the news that Jesus has been victorious. Though we're not yet told exactly how or what the triumph looks like, we'll learn that in a minute. And we're not even explicitly told yet that this is referring to Jesus. But we are given two clear symbolic references to Old Testament promises of the Messiah, which Jesus fulfilled. He is the Lion of Judah and the Root of David. In other words, John was told that the expected Messiah had indeed come, and he has triumphed. The promised Redeemer has arrived, not only to rule the nations, but to open the scroll and fulfill God's eternal purposes. All that John had hoped for had happened in Christ. So he should stop weeping and begin rejoicing. Christ has prevailed in the struggle and made a way for God's salvation and kingdom. The good news of Jesus is true, and it makes a profound difference for all of history. It makes a huge difference for all that John and his readers were going through, and it makes a difference for every part of our life as well. And then the vision changes gears to explain how the Lion has triumphed and what this meant for John and the readers. And so John transitioned to describing what he saw next. And he did not see a lion, as you might expect, but rather he saw a lamb on God's throne, looking like it had been slaughtered. So it turns out, in the symbolism of Revelation, that the lion is a lamb, and the lamb is a lion. Now, we're not supposed to visualize some blended creature that's half lion and half lamb. This is just a combined metaphor, adding one symbol to another to tell the fuller picture of all that Christ is and has done. Because technically, he's neither a lion or a lamb. He is God incarnate. And a lion and a lamb are symbols used to describe something about him. But in the symbolism, he's not half lion and half lamb. He is all lamb and all lion. He's not a wimpy lamb, but a kingly, strong, warrior lamb. And he's not a beastly lion, but a gentle, humble lion who gives himself on behalf of others. Now, these symbols might seem like they don't fit together, but they highlight how Jesus was a leader that was different than their expectations. And we saw earlier in this course that they expected a warrior king, but got a suffering servant. Now, in Revelation, we see clearly that Jesus is also a warrior king who will defeat all evil, but he turned out to be far better than just a military king. And one of the primary ways that he was victorious is that he gave himself as a sacrificial offering on behalf of the sins of his people. Remember that he does not win just by sheer power, but also by holiness and righteousness and grace. He is just and the one who justifies. He rules like a lion because he died like a lamb. And he rose triumphant over all creation, not only because he is the sovereign one on the throne, which he is, but also because he is the one who conquered death itself. He rules in strength because he gave of himself in apparent weakness, and he therefore is worthy to open the scroll. And John pointed out that the Lamb was in the center of God's throne. The Lamb was in God's place on the throne, in order to emphasize that the Lamb is God. The Lamb, who symbolizes Jesus, is equal with God, sharing his throne in a way that the elders and living creatures do not. Yet the Lamb is distinguished from the Eternal One sitting on the throne. And this fits well with the traditional doctrine of the Trinity, and doesn't make much sense unless the Trinity is true. And also the lamb looked like it had been slaughtered, referring to a violent death. And this clearly connects back to the Old Testament sacrificial system, where a lamb was often killed as a sacrifice in order to provide atonement for God's people. And elsewhere in the New Testament and the rest of Revelation, Jesus is referred to as the Lamb that was slain and the Lamb that takes away the sins of the world. And in a few verses, John will elaborate more on what the Lamb's death means for his people. But here also, John described the Lamb as having seven horns and seven eyes. Now, horns are a regular Bible symbol for kingly power. And the number seven usually symbolizes perfection and completeness. In other words, the Lamb is said to have the fullness and perfection of kingly power and authority. Now, later in Revelation, evil beasts are said to have 10 horns, and they attempt to challenge the rule of the Lamb. We all know in arithmetic, 10 is greater than 7, but in this symbolism, 10 horns represents a lot of power, but 7 horns represents the perfection and totality of power. So the Lamb is stronger than all pretenders to earthly power and authority. He is the true and perfect King. And as we saw in part 1, eyes are a symbol for knowledge, with 7 eyes symbolizing perfect knowledge. The Lamb is aware of everything that happens in the universe. He is all-knowing. And this is reinforced by the reference to the 7 spirits of God sent out into all the earth. We already saw the 7 spirits of God mentioned in the last chapter. And this points back to the book of Zechariah, where it says, "The 7 eyes of the Lord that ranged throughout the earth." Therefore, the 7 spirits symbolize the all-searching, all-seeing, and therefore all-knowing character of God and the Lamb. There is no part of creation that the Lamb does not intimately know and control. This is yet another confirmation of the deity of Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, that was all a description of the Lamb which John saw in his vision. And then he moved on to tell what the Lamb did. The Lamb went and took the scroll from the right hand of the one sitting on the throne. The taking of the scroll is the climax of this entire vision. The taking of the scroll represents the commencement of the consummation, which has been promised throughout the New Testament. The final preparation for all of God's good purposes are now underway, moving towards full accomplishment. The finishing events are already started and will inevitably come to completion. The taking of the scroll sets in motion the rest of the book of Revelation, as we'll see in a bit. Now, this passage also emphasized that the Lamb, symbolizing Christ, was worthy to take the scroll. This is a demonstration that he had completed his perfect, effective work, that his sacrifice on the cross had been accepted. The cross and resurrection were the most important events in all of human history, and the taking of the scroll to complete God's purposes is the planned result of the cross and resurrection. God's design for history will be consummated because God's plan on the cross has already taken place in history. Successfully, I should add. All the events described and symbolized in Revelation are the application and working out of the consequences of the gospel, which had already been accomplished in history when John wrote Revelation. John is encouraging his readers that all the benefits of the gospel are now in process of being worked out, even when it seems like evil is still winning. The result of the atonement and resurrection of Christ is the consummation of all things, which is already started, as symbolized by the Lamb taking the scroll. We've talked about how we're in the already not yet tension, but part of that tension is already because the Lamb has taken the scroll. And the not yet is already in the works and guaranteed. And then the rest of this vision is the response to the Lamb opening the scroll. First John told the immediate response to the Lamb taking the scroll, and that response was worship and celebration. Heaven exploded with joy at the triumph of the Lamb. Now, that would be blasphemy if the Lamb were not equal with God himself. The Lamb is worshipped as God, which is more evidence of the Trinity. And all the details tell how and why the Lamb was worshipped. Just like in the previous chapter, this chapter describes both the actions and the words used in worship. So when the Lamb took the scroll, the living creatures and the elders fell down in worship before the Lamb. And John recorded that they each worshipped with a harp and a bowl of incense. A harp represents joyfulness and celebration. Heaven is a happy place because of God's greatness and justice. God's righteousness and greatness are sometimes hidden on earth, but they have been fully manifested in heaven by the glory and justice of the Lamb. And that is a guarantee that this joy in his glory and justice will eventually be fully manifested on earth as well. And they each worship with a bowl of incense, which represents the prayers of the saints. Now, in the next chapter, the saints are described as crying out for justice because they've been persecuted and killed for their faith. So here, the prayers of the suffering, persecuted people of God are included in the worship of the Lamb. Because he received the scroll and was beginning to bring about the consummation. The consummation includes the vindication, justice, and eternal reward for God's faithful people. Their suffering is not in vain, and God will repay because of the Lamb. Their prayers actually made it to the throne of God. Their prayers have been effective and have been answered by the Lamb taking the scroll. And so, heaven sang, worshiping the Lamb with music. And John emphasized that they sang a new song. Now, that's not talking about new styles of music or addressing that issue at all. Whenever the Bible talks about singing a new song, it's in the context of God having done something new to sing about. In other words, the new song is a response to the new thing that God has done. Heaven has just experienced a new revelation of God's greatness and salvation. The Lamb has overcome and is now beginning to bring God's purposes to consummation. He's taken the scroll, and so heaven responds to this new phase of history with a new song. Now, sometimes we can take that for granted. Like, well, of course, Jesus rose from the dead. And we don't always realize what a monumental thing that really is. Think about it. If Jesus had not died and risen, God's purposes would not be fulfilled. There would not be a single redeemed person. There would not be a new heavens and a new earth. There would not be a people of God enjoying him forever. There would be no hope at all. But Christ has died and risen from the grave. The universe has forever changed for the better. Therefore, there is a dramatic new thing to sing about, and therefore, heaven exploded with praise. And the content of the new song is that Christ is worthy. This is basically repeating back the earlier challenge, where the angel said, "Who is worthy to take the scroll and open its seals?" And the answer here in the song is, "The Lamb is worthy to take the scroll and open its seals." That's who's worthy. And they elaborate and proclaim some of the reasons why he is worthy. First, because he was slaughtered. It's not just the fact that he died, or even the manner in which he died, because thousands of people died on Roman crosses. It's because he lived a perfect sinless life and did not need to die for his own sins, and so he could die for the sins of his people. It's because he was the innocent substitutionary sacrifice voluntarily offered to pay the penalty of the transgressions of others. The meaning, purpose, and result of his death on the cross as an atoning sacrifice is a primary reason why the Lamb is worthy of worship. And the same idea continues in the next phrase, that he purchased people for God. In earlier sections, we've talked about the idea of atonement and redemption. The Christ's death purchased our freedom and release from the guilt, punishment, and power of our sin. This idea is seen throughout the New Testament and reinforced here. And then John highlighted that the people redeemed by his death represent all groups of humanity. Not every human, but every kind and group of humanity is represented. Every ethnic group, every language group, every national group, and every social group is impacted by the redemption of Christ. And all these groups will be seen in the makeup of God's people for all eternity. And speaking of all eternity, the living creatures also mentioned, as part of the reason that the Lamb is worthy, that he gave his people a calling and a destiny. He made us to be a kingdom and priest to our God, and we will rule with him upon the earth. And that fulfills the Old Testament promises that God's people would be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, and that his people would be stewards over creation. The atonement of the Lamb has brought about the restoration of God's people to his high calling for us. Because of the Lamb, your life has meaning and direction and significance. We will participate in God's rule of the universe and his restoration of all things, and all genuine believers have a significant part to play. Now, of course, there are many more reasons why Jesus is worthy of all praise and worship, but these are the specific things mentioned in this passage in their praise to the Lamb. They rehearse the gospel and its consequences for God's people as the reason why the Lamb is worthy of worship. And of course, the clear implication is that God's people should participate in that praise of Jesus, even now. And that's also implied in the rest of the passage, where the worship is expanded to include all of heaven, and then later to include all of creation. In the last paragraph of this passage, John broadened the focus to depict absolutely everything worshiping the Lamb and the one sitting on the throne. John next described an uncountable number of angels around the throne joining in the worship of the Lamb. And they also were proclaiming with a loud voice that the slaughtered Lamb is worthy. Notice that this verse, again, highlights that the Lamb was slaughtered, and it highlights that he is worthy. And both of those items repeat the emphases from earlier verses. And the content of their praise echoes what we saw back in chapter 4, verse 11, where the one sitting on the throne was praised with similar language. The Lamb as well is worthy to receive. And again, he does not receive in the sense that we could give him something he doesn't already have. Like I've often told students, I don't give them a grade. I just write down the grade that they've earned. In a similar way, heaven does not give these things to the Lamb, but recognizes and acknowledges the fittingness, the rightness of the Lamb possessing these things. They proclaim 7 attributes that the Lamb is worthy to receive: power, riches, wisdom, strength, honor, glory, and blessing. And the fact that there are 7 may indicate that the Lamb is worthy to receive the perfection and fullness of all praise and blessing and glory, etc. Now, I've tried to explain these terms in more detail in the additional resource I mentioned earlier, if you want to explore them further. But to summarize, all heaven proclaims that the Lamb is worthy of worship because he's qualified to fulfill the destiny of the universe. And he has fulfilled that destiny by his death and resurrection. And he will fulfill God's planned destiny for the universe by bringing it all to completion, as will be narrated in the rest of this book. Then in John's vision, the praise is expanded even more to include all of creation. all creation in heaven and on the earth and under the earth. Now, that's the same wording that was used earlier in the challenge to find who is worthy. The challenge went out to all of those places. Just as no one in all those places was found worthy, now everyone in all those same places proclaims that the Lamb is worthy. And here, the sea is added as well. And John expressly mentioned everything in all of these places proclaiming this blessing on the Lamb and the one sitting on the throne. Nothing in all creation is excluded. Even those who are not ultimately saved will still recognize and acknowledge the greatness of God. Just as Paul predicted that every tongue will acknowledge that Jesus is Lord, so John sees all creation proclaiming his blessedness and glory. At the consummation, all creation will be renewed and transformed, so all creation is part of the worship of the Lamb. And the content of creation's worship is similar to the previous verse and the worship in chapter 4. And John's purpose in recording the content of this worship is not just to inform the reader what was stated, but also to impress the reader with the awe of the worship being given and the overwhelming legitimacy of the reasons why the Lamb is worthy, and thereby to invite and encourage the reader to participate in the same kind of worship. And notice that this worship is directed both to the one sitting on the throne and to the Lamb. They both together are objects of worship, which is still more evidence for the deity of Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity. The content of the worship, like the previous expressions, focuses on the greatness and sovereign ruling power of God. And he has and will have these characteristics for all eternity. In the previous chapter, it was emphasized that God lives forever. And here, all creation proclaims that he will gloriously rule forever and ever, which is yet another reason for heartfelt worship, which we should join. And then finally, John mentioned once again that the living creatures joined in all this worship, signaling their agreement with the word Amen, and the elders followed by bowing down in worship. So the vision of worship started most closely around God's throne. Then it expanded out to an uncountable cloud of angels, and then to all of creation. And then now, the focus is coming back to the inner circle, and eventually back to the throne of God himself. Just as all things find their source in the throne of God, all things find their goal in returning back towards the throne of God in delight and worship. That is the destiny of all of God's people, and it is guaranteed because the Lamb has been revealed, and he has overcome, and he is worthy to open the scroll and bring all of God's purposes to their designed consummation. And so, it is right and fitting to respond with heartfelt worship. Now, let me try to summarize all that we've seen in these two chapters. At the center of the universe is God upon his throne. He is glorious beyond description and surrounded by things that demonstrate his greatness, perfection, and power. Everything is dependent on him and finds its meaning in him. And the proper response to this God is heartfelt worship, acknowledging his greatness and our complete dependence on him. He is holy, completely different and better than all creation. And heaven responds with awe and delight and submission and the appropriate outward expressions of these things. And this holy and sovereign God has a scroll containing his purposes and inheritance for all creation. And the challenge was to find someone worthy to open the scroll and fulfill his purposes, but no one was found, which was cause for tremendous grief. If God's plan does not come to completion, we are most to be pitied. There's no hope and no meaning to life. And all that we do and suffer in this life is completely in vain. But a Savior has been revealed, who is described both as a conquering lion and as a slaughtered lamb. This one, symbolizing Christ, is worthy to fulfill God's purposes because he's died for his people and risen from the grave. Christ has overcome and has set in motion the consummation of the kingdom. And because he too is on the throne, he will certainly bring it to its intended conclusion. And for all this, Christ, along with the one sitting on the throne, is worshipped forever and ever by all of heaven and all of creation. He truly is worthy of all honor and praise because he has died to purchase his people and their destiny. And he's raised from the dead, conquering all his enemies, and he is ruling and will rule over everything forever. And all this is a key to understand the rest of the book of Revelation. Chapter 6 through 20 narrate the opening of the seals and the results coming from that. In the very next verse after this passage, at the start of chapter 6, Christ begins to open the seals of the scroll, which brings about monumental events to bring history to its intended conclusion. And that includes pouring out punishment on sinful humanity, and it also includes evil trying to fight back in a last-ditch, futile effort to resist the Sovereign One sitting on the throne and the Lamb, even by persecuting God's people on earth. But we'll look at all that in the next supplemental section. But Christ is on the throne and will continue to expose and conquer evil and bring his people to their inheritance in the new heaven and new earth. And then chapters 21 and 22 narrate the content of the scroll, the eternal blessing of God's people in his presence forever. This is reality. Christ has won, and he is in process of consolidating and expressing his victory in all of creation, including our personal and corporate histories. Human kings and rulers pretend to have all control, but that's not reality, only propaganda. John's readers suffered for a while because they would not say Caesar is Lord. Rather, they said Jesus is Lord. And they were right. And now they are enjoying their reward. The full truth might be behind the scenes right now, but God has made it known in this passage. And therefore, we should see all of our lives from that perspective. And that brings us to the question of what now? What difference should all this make in our lives? Well, in one sense, our response to this passage should be the same as our response to the entire book of Revelation, which we touched on in the survey of the whole book. But I also want to give a few suggestions based on these specific chapters. First, we should have a right view of God. Of course, some parts of your thinking about God might need very little adjustment, and others may need a whole lot of correction. But all of us should seek to conform all of our view of God to the truths revealed in this passage. Because sometimes our ideas about God are way too small. God is the infinite, holy, glorious, all-powerful God, and nothing else is even close to being like him. God is sovereign king over all because he is the source and creator of all. He has not left the universe to run on its own, but he is purposely guiding all of history to his good purposes. He's revealed himself personally in Jesus, who is God, and who became human to fulfill God's plans for humanity that we could not do on our own. And therefore, we should have a right view of ourselves and our relation to God, that we are completely dependent on him, not only for our existence, but also for our meaning, purpose, and destiny. We exist only in relation to him, and we should live in light of the fact that he is God and we are not. We should seek to know and buy into and intentionally live out the purposes for which he created us. And one of our primary purposes is to recognize, acknowledge, and delight in God's greatness and goodness, and return the fitting, deserved honor and praise back to him. And we should have a right view of history and all that is happening in the world around us. History is not just random, but it is the working out of God's plan. And even though it might not look great at times, because there are enemies of God still active for a while longer, the decisive victory has already been won. And the Lamb is right now in process of completing all the preparations to consummate the fullness of God's glorious eternal kingdom purposes. And therefore, when we have conformed our thinking on these topics to the truths that we learn in this passage, it should impact us in a few other ways. First, we should be encouraged. Encouraged in the sense that it should free us from anxiety and despair. God is still on the throne, and the bad guys will not ultimately win. But we should also be encouraged in the sense that this should give us courage. We should have courage to stand up against evil in all its forms, because we know we are on the ultimate right side of history, and we will win, even if we're persecuted or even killed in the meantime. Knowing God and knowing that He is working out His good plan frees us from the fear of man and anxiety about the future. And we should trust and remain faithful, no matter what comes. History has some seasons of great prosperity and righteousness. And history also has seasons of great tyranny and rejection of righteousness. And we are called to be God's faithful people and His faithful witnesses, no matter which season we're living in. And we can trust Him in every season, because He is the trustworthy King and the Lamb who was slaughtered to bring us to our glorious destiny. And that leads us to our final fitting response, which is worship. We should regularly remind ourselves of the kind of God that He is and all the things that He has done for us. And the regular worship gatherings of a local church is a great way to do this. We should be regularly exposed to the truth about Christ, His character, and His salvation. And we should join with all of heaven and with God's people in the fitting response of gratitude, honor, joy, delight, heartfelt praise, and an attitude and lifestyle in submission and obedience to such a great God. These are some of the appropriate ways that we can respond to the heavenly vision that we have seen in this passage. So now, let's review. In this passage, we learn God is beyond description, God is self-existent, and that means that we are dependent on Him for everything. God is creator, and that means that we're debtors to Him for everything. God is Lord of history, and that means that we get meaning and direction from God's purposes. God is a gracious redeemer who was slaughtered to purchase us back from destruction and who's conquered all our enemies. And that means that we are double debtors for everything, debtors for our creation and debtors for our redemption. And God has destined us to inheritance as His people. That means that we are double dependent debtors with a direction and destiny beyond doubt. And that should cause a response of worship, because He is worthy. Now, I hope that this attitude of awe and gratitude is what you've experienced as we work through this passage. And like I said earlier, there's so much more in this passage than that we could look at. But I hope this has given you a solid understanding of the main ideas in these chapters. And I also pray that you take this message to heart and let it encourage and motivate you to stand firm and faithful, knowing the true reality of history, because you've been given a peek behind the scenes. In the next supplementary section, we will explore some of the resistance to God's kingdom and how God's people can overcome, as described later in Revelation. And I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for watching.